This is a segment from the Annex Sociology Podcast. For more information, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
So I was digging around on Twitter and found an interesting blog post written by Nick Wolfinger from Utah, right?
Yeah.
Utah. And Nick was writing about, I guess this was in response to Jordan Peterson talking about how postmodernism has overrun sociology. And Nick did some informal polling of colleagues and found that there was no postmodernism or little to no postmodernism going around in the discipline. I guess the implication is that this, you know, this is sort of an empty argument or a poor characterization that Jordan Peterson is making of us. I have a little bit of a different perspective, but what do you guys feel on this one? Is postmodernism an issue in sociology? Is it dead?
I have seen exactly one article in sociology that used the term postmodernism, and right. It was almost 20 years ago. And the way it used it, it literally, the only implication of it was, let's not have aggregated class schema categories like Erickson, Goldthorpe, Bordesaro, but let's just have totally disaggregated to the occupational level, which isn't typically right. What people think of when they say the word.
Not at all.
But that's the only thing I've ever seen in sociology. The term itself basically doesn't exist in soci, and for all practical purposes, never has. I do feel that people use the term loosely, though, and people, especially when they're using it not to say I'm a postmodernist, but you are a postmodernist. they don't necessarily mean specific. They don't have a thoroughgoing taxonomy of what they're criticizing. They basically just mean you are doing a style of research that I don't like. And so it's a little bit like, you can imagine in 1915 somebody talking about, you know, anarchists. And, you know, there's anarchist terrorism and stuff like that. The people they're talking about are actually early Bolsheviks or something like that. Right. But they don't know the difference. They just know that these are left-wing radicals who are creating problems. And they don't realize that, you know, there's some deep theoretical differences between anarchists and socialists, but they're using the terms interchangeably. So I feel that there's probably some of that. I feel like when Peterson says postmodern, he really means like critical, that sort of thing.
I hear anti-science. That's what I hear.
Sure.
It's like this conception of there being no truth. It's this conception that everything is, socially constructed and a style of theorizing that reduces to opinion.
Yeah. So there's really two questions, right? There's what A, is postmodern in the limited sense in sociology? And I think we can all agree that it is not, and it basically never has been. And then the more interesting question is, okay, if we take Peterson seriously but not literally, as people always say about the president,
right.
You know, is there the kind of thing that he seems to have in mind when he mislabels it as postmodern? How much of that is there in sociology? And there I think the answer is some. But we can have a serious argument about how much.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, to me, just to some of Gabriel's points, I mean, I tend to agree that postmodernism hasn't been a thing in sociology as in other disciplines, right? I mean, it's not as though, you know, a group formed and said, okay, we will be the postmodernists, right? And this will be our school of thought. I think there definitely have been sociologists who have been labeled as postmodern, if not by themselves, then definitely by people often from other disciplines, but sometimes within sociology as being postmodernists, right? So that's this sort of parsing hairs that I have with Gabriel on that issue. I also think that, I don't want to get into this argument again about objectivity, right? But I think a lot of how you take that statement I think has to do with, you know, sort of what kind of, you know, epistemological lens you're using to think about the world and also then to think about your approach to, you know, the methods that you're going to use and the data that you're going to use to try and reveal some aspect of reality, right? I mean, I don't think that it's that most postmodernists don't think that there is reality. They think that there are multiple layers of reality, right? And it's not that they think that, you know, every single thing is a potential fact, right? But they question how we get to this idea of fact. So,
all right. Well, first of all, insofar as, let's say, an anti-objectivity or anti-positivism or whatever you want to call it, is Wolfinger, if we take postmodernism to mean anti-science, do you think Wolfinger is right that that sentiment is a rarity in our discipline and that the mainstream is quite scientific or, you know, would meet sort of some type of objectivity oriented line of inquiry?
Yeah, for the most part, we can put this more positively and say, like, you know, how many people are what philosophers of science would call scientific realists, which basically means that you think science is possible. And I think that is probably true of most of the discipline, that most of us are basically taking a scientific approach. So I think Wolfinger's right in that. I have some questions about his coding scheme, where, you know, the way he operationalized this is he included race, class, gender as reflecting intersectionality as part of this, like, not postmodernism literally, but what Peterson seems to have in mind is that. But, you know, I hear plenty of people talk about, I would say that something like critical race theory does belong in what Peterson is calling postmodernism, but just race, class, gender in general doesn't. And I don't think that that set of terminology to basically mean a broad interest in inequality necessarily correlates with intersectionality, because I see intersectionality as a much more specific concept that basically means you pay a lot of attention to the interaction terms. And it's possible to have an approach to that that more or less pays attention to the main effects. And I wouldn't say that. And I also think that's entirely possible to have studies of race, studies of class, studies of gender that are in no sense based on critical theory, but take, like, you know, an entirely conventional epistemological realist, let's just do the regressions type approach.
Okay, so I have just to be clear, Gabriel, you're not trying to say that all critical race theory isn't concerned with objectivity? Is that, you're not saying that, right?
I'm not saying that. I don't have an extensive knowledge of critical race theory. I would say that some of it probably falls in that, some of it probably doesn't. But I do think that it is the kind of thing that Peterson has in mind when he's complaining about trends. And I think it's, I think that when he says postmodern, you should think critical race theory and stuff like that. And he doesn't actually mean literary theory that was fashionable in the 1990s.
Got it.
Yeah, I think when we're talking about, so I would agree with Gabe that this idea, like, there's very little of this actual postmodernism. What there is some in sociology is, you know, there's certain theorists that are identified as, like, as sort of kissing cousins to postmodernism, people like Foucault in particular, you know, who are widely read and cited within sociology, and some of these, you know, Frankfurt School Marxists, maybe less so. You know, there's certainly that. I think, and then there's also, I mean, I think what, you know, makes people like Peterson maybe a bit on edge is this sort of, that we were talking about earlier, about sort of questioning sort of some idea of this blanket sort of universal reality that is, like, unmediated and experienced by, you know, can be experienced by all just by observation or something like that. And there is a sort of, you know, I don't know how much to quantify it, but there is a trend in sociology that sort of takes that into account, that, you know, that, you know, maybe, you know, empirical reality isn't so easily observable and is influenced by our subjective experience of it.
The irony is that, I mean, I've never watched a Peterson lecture, I've never read a Peterson essay, but my understanding is that he's obsessed with culture. And a lot of his shtick is basically self-help lessons from Western civ. Which is kind of a, you know, that's a cultural approach. It's not like a, you know, a totally naive empiricism approach. So it's not like he doesn't care about culture, doesn't take culture seriously. There just seems to be certain approaches to that same subject that, you know, so it's not like he's a hardcore paleo-Marxist materialist or something like that. but there seem to be certain approaches to culture that piss him off.
My thing with Nick's take is that I always find, I mean, I've heard this take a few times, and I think it reflects the more elite ranks of our discipline. We're talking about faculty members, like research professors, and usually at higher status universities. And I wonder if you took the totality of the discipline, that's everybody who's delivering sociology instruction or writing as a sociology faculty member of any sort, including adjuncts. Do you think that Nick's conclusions hold, that this is a rarity in the discipline? Or do you think street culture in the discipline is more, you know, opinion oriented?
Well, I'm always going to side with the general position that within sociology, elitism is fully justified as a heuristic. You know, I think, I mean, and I've always said this to people, like when I'm talking to people who aren't sociologists and like, what's it like? You know, I always tell them that at the elite levels in ASR and the top departments, everyone is extremely professional and just about trying to get the facts. And, you know, 95% of people are, you know, going to vote for the Democrat or something like that. But it kind of doesn't matter because people are so professional in their approach. Right. But I also think that that tends to break down when you get to some of the people who aren't as research oriented and have more of a scholar activist orientation as like the core of their identity.
But don't you think that ignoring that group is what gets us where we are? You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing to say, well, when I say sociology, what I mean are the higher status research slice of the discipline. But it's a minority in my view. And if we don't think about, you know, popular culture within the discipline, we ignore it, then we can let things, you know, run amok, and it hurts the overall, reputation of the discipline.
Well, I mean, this is a common issue, right? Like when you try and define, like, let's say that we weren't sociologists talking about our own discipline, but we were religion scholars.
Right.
And we were trying to define what Catholicism is. Is Catholicism a bunch of papal encyclicals and, church council creeds? Or is it, you know, whatever peasants do in their devotional practice, you know, like worshiping dog saints, which was a common practice until about 100 years ago?
Well, those are sociology students, right? It'd be more like, what's the local priest saying?
Yeah. So, but I'm just saying, like, you know, in one sense, yeah, Catholicism is a monotheistic religion, you know, based on faith and reason. And there's a lot of influence from Plato and Aristotle and that sort of thing. And in another sense, it's French peasants worshiping a dog that was a faithful dog, but people misunderstood that, and so they drowned it.
No.
So in one sense, and they're both true. Mm. It just takes, you take this kind of top-down elite perspective based on the understanding of intellectuals of themselves, or do you look at a bottom-up approach of saying, of the modal person who may not be particularly noteworthy or influential, what is kind of the practice of that person on the ground? Mm-hmm. Which is usually much more incoherent in some ways than what the elites are doing. And they both are accurate descriptions. And you're not really going to understand it if you just take one and you say, oh, they're a bunch of superstitious peasants, or, oh, they're a bunch of erudite theologians, because they're both true. Mm-hmm. And the same is true of sociology, right? That sociology is both a rigorous empirical discipline. It is, you know, relatively neutral in understanding the facts and pursuing them through rigorous methodologies. And it's a bunch of people who see themselves as scholar activists and, you know, put a bunch of salon.com articles on their syllabi.
But there's a difference. There's a difference between scholar activism and postmodernism, I would say.
Oh, sure.
I think that it's important to make that distinction, and that, you know, that, you know, certainly if you look at sort of beyond the, you know, top 20 research universities, you know, there's a difference in the type of sociologist practice, but I think it has more to do with sort of the necessity of sort of catering to a student body that has more practical concerns. And, you know, you have to deal with, some more applied sociology or something like that. But I don't necessarily, I would be very skeptical that there's some sort of like storm of postmodern, like anti-positivism sort of brewing beneath some objective elite at the top. I just don't think that.
No.
I would be very skeptical of that.
Yeah. And, you know, and I've read the article just really quickly, but I thought the argument was the other way around, was that at the most elite schools, like postmodernism isn't a thing, but at the lower tier schools, you're slightly more likely to see postmodernism.
But what you're just more likely to see is race, class, gender. So it goes back to that point.
Oh,
how do we live together? How do we view that race, class, gender as a research interest? What does that signal?
But there's plenty of race, class. I'd say race, class, gender is the modal interest at top 10 schools.
Yes, and there is an entire section called race, class, gender.
And I'm just saying, but I don't associate an interest in race, class, and gender as necessarily being anything but rigorous. You know, it's the core of the discipline, and there's plenty of incredibly rigorous research addressing those topics, such as, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about Paula England, right? She's a gender scholar. She's incredibly rigorous, and she just got elected to the National Academy of Sciences, and deservedly so.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder whether or not part of that race, class, gender thing is mistaking having all three in the title means that you're taking an intersectional approach.
That was Nick's assumption, and I think Nick was incorrect on that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, yeah, I think that's incorrect. I think you're totally right.
But there's two types of intersectionality, right? There's, like Gabriel said, there's the interaction effects where you're like, wow, being Black hurts your earnings and being female hurts your earnings, but being Black and female really hurts your earnings. And then
no, it doesn't actually. Wait, Joe, you got it backwards. The interaction effect of female and Black is positive.
All right, well, whatever. This is a hypothetical example, but thank you for that. But like you get the main point. And then there is another brand of sociology that maybe is more engaged in, I think, what conservatives would disparage as identity politics or things like that.
Yeah, but that's crazy, right? I mean, it's not necessarily so. I mean, I think that there's a very legitimate school of thought that says you can't actually like just take the averages of two things and make it the average scores of two things and actually think that by putting them together, you have like some like window into reality. I mean, like you can't separate out being a woman and being Black for a Black woman.
Well, I think that this is partly a marketing problem. I think the reason that people, if intersectionality were just presented as, look, there's very often a lot of really big interaction terms. And so, you know, studying white women and Black men doesn't necessarily let you infer anything about Black women. I don't think anybody would have a problem with that. I think that it gets picked up from the way it gets used politically, in that, you know, you'll have kind of intra-social movement fights where somebody will say, oh, you know, this gay rights movement, say, is only representing the interests of cis white men. Or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that's not an intersectional approach to, you know, gender, blah, 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 blah. And then I think you get a lot of people kind of eye rolling at intersectionality being used as effectively a banner for rallying people in intra-social movement debates. And they just think of like, these are just people who bitch, you know, and so it gets seen as an obnoxious thing on the basis of the way it's used politically. But if people instead just understood it as, here's this empirical pattern that there's very often large interaction terms, and so you can't just naively look at the main effects, I don't think anyone would have a problem with it.
Well, I think in terms of the marketing, I don't know if it's so much marketing as the fact that, you know, movements like Black Lives Matter took that term intersectionality and they used what was this academic term, right? This academic way of looking at the things, and they used it in order to think through and enact their politics and their political agendas. And then people who'd never heard of intersectionality, right, or had never read any scholarship on intersectionality before, you know, the term basically gets, you know, I don't know, adopted by these very political social movements, then start equating the two, right? I mean,
yeah, it's basically a left wing chain migration. Yeah. And you know, here's this term of longstanding academic provenance that describes an interesting and useful empirical phenomena. It gets picked up by activists, politicized. It gets abused in a purely theoretical sense, in that chain migration does not describe a category of visas. It describes a pattern of behavior. And those visas may encourage that pattern of behavior, but fundamentally it's a pattern of behavior. Likewise, intersectionality doesn't mean attention to ascriptive inequality. It basically means the interaction terms of ascriptive inequality. But in its political usage, it basically just means like broad coalition of people with concerns about ascriptive things. And that's the irony of like Black Lives Matter is the title is Black Lives Matter, not Black Lives Matter, but in different ways, depending on whether you're gay or straight, cis or trans, male or female, right? Well, it's just Black Lives Matter. So it's the nature of the movement is emphasizing the main effect, and they'll still use the term, this kind of the slogan of intersectionality, even if they're actually playing up the main effect. So just like chain migration, the term gets abused in a purely theoretical sense as it gets adopted, but the politicization turns people off of the term.
Barry?
Well, I mean, the analogy of chain migration is kind of, I thought you were talking about the political effects, because I mean, I think that that's clearly a politicized term that's used instead of the previous term we used to use, which is family reunification, right?
Yes.
And I think that...
And they're two different things, actually. Yeah. We used to use chain migration, but for a totally different thing.
Yeah, but that's sort of how it's come to be. Like when people say chain migration now, what they're really talking about is family reunification, and they're sort of like dismissing sort of extended family ties. And I think that, you know, that's the same thing with intersectionality, is that there it's come to have this sort of political, baggage assembled with it, basically. And I mean, I think that you're right, that in that how it's used in the academy versus in contemporary social movements is two related but different things. I think that Gabe's right, that in the sense that intersectionality in the movements is sort of used as mainly as a signifier that basically just means like, I'm a committed anti-racist, anti-sexist, whatever, I have certain value commitments, but everybody sort of attaches these different meanings to it, I think. So.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.